Welcome to the Bullpen Session. This is Patrick Lillis. Glad you're here. Glad you're listening. Glad you're all right. Hope everybody's having a beautiful mid-December. Feels like an interesting time of year. You know, it's the end of the new year, starting to wrap up. Feels like if you're in a creative project, that's great. And if you're not, you're sort of in a holding pattern. And just talking to a friend of mine earlier today about that. You know, feels like, am I going to get a job? Is something going to happen between now and January? Probably not. So how do you stay creatively engaged and allow yourself to give, you know, do what you need to do and do what you want to do and also create space to recharge? I feel like I talked about that last year a lot. Just recharge, reevaluate, look at what do you want to be doing? What do you want to do in the new year? And make that commitment. But also take the time right now when a lot of I feel like the business is not happening. Nothing, a lot of change isn't going to happen. So set yourself up to do creatively what you want to do. And say that because I'm thinking about, you know, if you're an actor, I don't know what that means, but hopefully you self-generate work and write and take care of yourself. And this week, speaking of that, I'm talking to Scott Illingworth, director and friend and associate professor at NYU Grad Acting. And I talk about that because Scott is great. He's also an associate of Farm, but he's a great director that somebody I trust. He directed my solo show. He's directed a play of mine, and wanted to talk to him because he is been at an institution, been at NYU. I think he said 15 years, and he's on sabbatical this year, doing a lot of independent projects of his work and things that are interesting. And you're going to hear about a project he's doing in partnership with an artist in Ukraine that's really interesting. And I love talking to him for a lot of reasons, but one, I was really interested in the freedom of sabbatical, but also what is that being part of an institution do for you? And it's great. You'll hear him talk about it and us talk about, but the idea that he is at in an environment that allows him, because it's an academic environment and a training program, to bring his artistry to his work at all time, but also allowed him to help shape the work he does there and giving him the freedom to do that over time. And also a home base in which to bring, you know, create other relationships and projects outside of it. I really thought it was interesting because I have the Farm Theater for the last 9 years, but primarily as an artist feeling like a freelance person. And I thought, oh, I'm wondering what that is. And as I'm going to the new year, I'm thinking about change and I'm constantly thinking about what's the way to build something now for early career artists. And just really good to hear the value of the work he's doing and gets to do. And I'll let you enjoy the conversation. So with that, play ball.
About a couple days after the war started, this colleague I met when she came to NYU on a Fulbright, and then I worked with her again when I was in Kyiv on a Fulbright. And she is a teacher and actress and director, but she also runs this kind of school with teaching acting to Ukrainian kids in English. And so when the war started, she and I were in contact, and within a few days, she started recording interviews with some of her students as the war unfolded and having them record audio diaries, all of which was in English. And so in the past, you know, basically 10 months now, 8 to 10 months now, she and I have been working to put together this play using the audio clips from these interviews and audio diaries with the students. And we've gotten it now from like 80, went from 80 hours of audio down to about an hour and 15 minutes of this very kind of, you know, to me, gripping piece, which is full of interesting, specific experiences of all of these different young people as their families, and they figure out what's going to happen to them. Where are they going to land? Where do they, you know, as they become refugees, as they choose to stay or go. And so the piece itself is this audio that actors listen to live during the performance. So you hear the actors' voices doing the performance, but the entire time you watch them listen live to the audio that they're replicating from these interviews.
Wait, say that again. What are you watching?
You're watching the actors perform, actors perform on stage, but you see them listening live to this audio that they are then kind of replicating in the moment. So you never hear the audio itself, but you know that they're listening in real time to the audio recorded by these young Ukrainians.
And so, will this be a live performance?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's some physical stuff that will be part of the workshop. Right now, it's really just a script and this audio file, but the workshop is about trying to figure out what is the physical world of this play? What does it look like? And part of the point of doing it that way is, these audio clips are recorded in all sorts of different environments and over lots of different time. And by kind of putting them together in this way, the actors manage to make it a more cohesive experience, the narrative, even though the audio clips are kind of from all over the place.
But they start to find a through line, almost like the text of a play. They start to have cause and effect. This
That's right.
point leads to
Yeah.
this point leads to this point.
Or even taking one student's experience, one of the people's experience, and putting it right, the audio of that, and then these two people physically right next to each other or interacting in some way, even though those two people didn't interact, you start to build kind of connections and narrative that the audio maybe originally didn't have, but that the play has.
And when you say play, where are you imagining this presentation? Is it, or who are you workshopping it with someone, or?
Yeah, I'm workshopping it with a group of actors, just people who I know and like, and who I think more importantly know would be good in this kind of work or are curious about working in this unique way. Basically the reason for the workshop is to put something together that then we can invite potential theaters and backers and folks to come and see in the hopes that someone will, be motivated to produce it.
I'm also interested in, you met this person who came over on a Fulbright, and then you went over and worked with them. And I asked what you were doing on sabbatical, but I think it's great that you get to that you encountered them through your role at NYU. And yeah, I want to know more about it because you're on the sabbatical, and the other things you've been doing is like, does this come from the work of NYU, or is it allowing you to do what you want to do because you have a break?
Yeah, I think it is increasingly harder for me to separate out what the kind of point of impulse is for those things because I've been at NYU now in some form or another almost 15 years. And so the result is, I think two things have happened. One is I've met and worked with various guest artists and folks from outside who come to NYU who then, if things go well, we have a good relationship that becomes a professional connection that then has other life beyond just us working together with the students at NYU. And then it's also true that, working with those students for those years, they're wonderful and you get to know them and their skills really well. And so it's quite common that in moments outside of NYU, when I think to be working on something like this, the people who come to mind first are mostly people who are alums of that program. And so it's quite a strange thing to think of them as separate. In some ways, the Ukraine thing is the most separate because my experience working over there in Kyiv was very much on my own. It didn't have any particular connection to NYU. And so this project has really felt like, at its core, a collaboration between me and my friend, Alex, who's, the Ukrainian teacher, and us working together on what this piece might be. And in a great way, it's felt like, I know for both of us, a thing that we could be doing at a time when one feels very powerless to do much of anything when there's a war happening, for me, in the easiest way, which is to feel far away, to care about a lot of people there, to care about the country, and yet not really be able to do much. And for her, being somebody who's now a refugee living, in Europe, and feeling quite powerless to affect, to do her work, to live her life. And yet here's a project that maybe in some small way feels like helping to tell the story of these students that she really cares about.
Yeah, and I also like, yeah, and I think it's a beautiful project, and I liked what you said about all the intertwinings of NYU. What I'm really interested in the idea of what it does for somebody, for an artist, right, to have a home base, and that home base being NYU, an institution. Let's start at the beginning. How'd you get there 15 years ago?
Well, I got there. It's entirely to the credit of Mark Wing Davey, who was the chair of the program, who's kind of the incoming chair of the program at that time, and is now the previous chair of the program. He and I met in Chicago. I was in graduate school at the theater school at DePaul University, getting my MFA in directing, and he was in town working on Sarah Rule's passion play at the Goodman Theater, and he needed an assistant director. And so a teacher of mine at DePaul said, "Hey, do you have any interest in talking to this director?" And I knew a bit about him. I had read a bit about him, and I thought, "Great, I would love to meet him." And so I didn't realize at the time how urgent the situation was. They were like a day into rehearsals already. And so I show up and we have a pretty quick conversation. And the next day I'm in rehearsal for this play. But Mark and I just hit it off. It happened to be at a moment in my life when I had a lot of time to devote to being there. And we really got along, and I felt really challenged by the work that was happening in the play. It was an exciting play to be a part of. And when that play ended, he was going to be in New York working on a show at the Public for Labyrinth Theater Company's play Unconditional by Brett Leonard. And he said, "Hey, do you think there's any chance your school would let you come to New York to assist me on this play for a couple months?" Because I was still in grad school. And he was, I said, "Well, I'll ask, and I did, and they very generously let me basically be there, take it as a kind of independent study. I had to Skype in, all pre-Zoom. I had to Skype into a class once a week and write something about the experience. But I got to be in New York for a couple of months working on that piece, working again with Mark. And that is the year that he got named chair of NYU's graduate acting program. We had a couple of other projects coming up. And basically, I thought, here's this guy who is giving me work, who sees something in me. He's asked me if I might be interested in teaching a workshop at NYU next year. I know I have at least two projects coming up with him. This is my moment. I'm going to move to New York. And I did. And then the especially the first 5 years I was in New York was a progression of working more and more, working lots of different schools, working more and more in graduate acting, and then eventually getting a full-time position there. That's a long answer, I know, but
Long is good. They don't need to hear me. But I was interested in that because I also love the idea that you lined up projects with Mark, and the idea of will you come in and do a workshop. Was that really like, did you do one workshop, like a one day thing, or was it a winter break? Like I remember we did a feels like a 2 week workshop of something.
Yeah, That first time, my memory is that it was just a couple of days, like a couple of sessions. And I think my hope was that it would go well enough that maybe I could teach a class, that I could maybe cobble together between teaching adjunct classes various places. I could work something out and get some, directing work and whatever as well. And that's pretty much what happened those first years. I was teaching in graduate acting. I also taught a class in the undergrad program at NYU. I taught at Marymount Manhattan. I taught various places. And then more and more work started happening in
And
the grad program.
were you looking to teach? Was that always a plan to be part of your post-grad school balance, your directing with teaching? Was that a goal?
Yeah, for sure. I knew that I wanted some balance of teaching and directing work. I didn't know exactly what I wanted that balance to be or what would feel right. But I knew that those two things were the things I wanted to be doing after grad school.
And I also, you're an intricate part of NYU grad acting. And I think it's interesting because I want to talk about what you teach, but you're a director,
Yeah.
right? And but you're primarily teaching in acting. And I've been in the class, so I know what the work is, but I think it's interesting if like you found a home where you get to do what you do. And I don't know if other it just feels like the perfect fit for the philosophy of the school. And was that because of Mark's work? Was that just them finding you creating a niche through your work? Or how did that come about? Because it's not like
Yeah.
you're teaching Meisner or you're teaching styles of the Elizabethan era or something. You teach a very specific, practical style of acting.
Yeah. I think it, I mean, I think it's a combination of, it's very much a credit to Mark in that he is, he's very supportive of like people themselves and then finding the way those people are going to kind of work with inside the school. And he was very good about identifying some things which were kind of low-hanging fruit, like me directing a play with the students felt like low-hanging fruit, right? But this other work that has developed over the years is really a function of me experimenting, finding my way to what felt like the right fit, not just for me, but also in relation to the other things that already existed in the program. So I wasn't merely, replicating something somebody else was doing, but what are the things that I can offer that feel unique enough and specialized enough that and in service of this larger whole? And that certainly developed over time. But it was also me saying, okay, I like this place. I like working here. I like the students and the colleagues. How can I be advocating for what I might be able to offer, because nobody's going to hand you that. So I have to figure out, okay, what can I say? What can I offer up? What can I kind of advocate for about my own skills? Just something I do not find easy to do, and hope that then other people see that as valuable.
I want to ask about that because I too probably am not as good at saying like, hey, I think I'd be valuable doing this. How do you bring that? Do you bring it up as a class? Do you bring it up as an idea? Do you go to Mark at the time as the chair and say, hey, I think there's something to this work I do this way. I'd love to expand it. Like, what is that conversation? And the reason I'm interested is because I'm really interested in the value of having being the role of an institution and what that opportunities provide you. Because I think, there's you go and you can teach a very specific thing, but there's also something of finding a home to grow a whole artistic, like you talked about. You're in, the playwrights you come in and work with. This teacher came from Kyiv to work. You met, and so. I just think it's great that it gets to blossom out of it. So inside of it, going back to the question, how do you approach that dialogue? How do you start to make it the environment that gets to utilize your skills?
Yeah, I think I'm sure there are some people who could just be like, hey, I'm awesome at this and you should hire me to do it. That's not me. I think the way I found it easiest to do, or with, you know, some integrity, is if I identified what it would be doing for the students, or what I felt like I could offer that's in service in some way of the students and this piece of their growth that would be improved by it. So when I was able to take the focus off of like, here's what I can do versus here's something I can help the students grow in, or here's something I think the students could use more growth in, and maybe I could be the person to help do that. That felt more in keeping with who I felt like I could be as a person, and helped me speak to it. But certainly it was an iterative process that, you know, I'm offering something and I'm seeing how it's working or not. And I'm hearing from the students, you know, in the course of a year or two, the way they're applying it or not. And then it's in conversation with the chair, you know, and Mark at the time saying, oh, you know, I've been doing this, but I think, what do you think about me leaning on this more, or expanding this, or getting rid of that piece of my class, or introducing a class that's focused on this? It was more about step by step. And I think now it's easy to sit here and be like, oh, the stuff I do makes perfect sense for me to be the person doing it, and it's fits the institution and whatever. But you know, that took time.
But yeah, it does make perfect sense for you to be the person doing it. And I'm really impressed that it to carve out that and have Mark recognize it, and for you to be able to build that, because that's a comfortable place to go and feel valued. And like you said, I think you've married the, like right now, the professional and the collaborations, you know, not because of one or the other, not because of NYU, but they're tied because whoever you work with, you can also bring there, and whoever you meet goes elsewhere. I am a little interested in that, actually, because I know that you've met, that there's playwrights who have come in and worked with the students. And how does that process happen? How do you, the ones you're going to work with, do you get to pick who you're working with? Are you interviewing people? Are you identifying people that you want to partner with that would be good for the department? Or how do you find?
Yeah, mostly it hasn't been me finding them. It's been a kind of arranged marriage, as it were. And, you know, it's just, here's these playwrights and they're getting commissioned, and we want you to do one of them this year. And we think this is, you know, sometimes a playwright comes in with a director, and so that's great. And we, it's a good opportunity for the students to meet that director, but then other times they're not necessarily. And sometimes that's when I would get connected with them. I mean, I think the two maybe best examples are the playwright Mona Mansour. The play I directed with her was the first play I ever directed at NYU. And she and I had never met. We just got paired up. We started going out for coffee, just talking about what she might be interested in writing about. And we made this play, and we've become great friends and collaborators. And we now have started this theater company together. And that was entirely an arranged situation that was just lucky. We found that we were good collaborators. And similarly, to a point, Lucas Haneth is another example of a writer who I didn't bring in and didn't know personally in any way before we got paired up. And we just had a really good time. We were really interested in similar things about the material. And Lucas is now also a professor at NYU, and he and I have continued, now that we're both colleagues there, to find opportunities for our classes to collaborate on things, to kind of push for little experiments between writers and actors. And it's been one of those things where the values we kind of discovered we shared in that collaboration have become ways we've tried to craft exercises for the students to use.
I'm curious why you started a theater company, but not why, but why now?
Right. Well, I didn't want to start a theater company, Patrick, honestly. In fact, I very much didn't want to. And I'm really glad that we did. But basically, Mona and I were workshopping a different piece years later at New Dramatists. We had a kind of workshop there. We were working on a new idea. And we had a bunch of actors, some of whom were NYU graduates and some weren't. And Mona periodically would say to me, we should start a theater company. And I would kind of, you know, wave it away. But in that room with a lot of NYU grads, she brought it up. And one in particular, this guy, Tim Nicolai, was kind of really latched onto it as a great idea. And basically, she and Tim continued to push for us to at least talk about this, talk about the idea and what it would mean. And so I got convinced by the notion of a company that did something that felt unique, that it wasn't just, we're going to start a company and produce plays or have a season of plays, but we're going to do something different, which is get a group of people together, a group of kind of creative folks of varying skills, you know, designers and actors and writers, directors. And we're going to do this kind of long form investigation into a topic. And then eventually a play comes out of that that we're going to produce. And it isn't devising in that everyone isn't involved in creating the final text. It's a shared research process. A writer writes the play, and then ostensibly the same group of people produces the play, acts in it, whatever, as was a part of the first piece of the research. That to me felt a little utopian. It felt a little like trying to bring the stuff you can do at an institution like, you know, at a university or something, and try to find a way to make it work in the professional world, which is really hard because of the finances. And that felt worth doing to me. And that is how I got convinced, now happily, to start a theater company.
I love that they convinced you. And then you form, how did you, did Tim start saying it out loud in rooms so that the ensemble became bigger and bigger? Like, how did it become birth that it is? Because it's a decent size. It's like 25 people, I think.
It is. That's exactly right. I think it is exactly 25 now. But basically, we decided we would start with a kind of, you know, soft launch, as it were. We'd invite, you know, a dozen or so people to an initial meeting, explain what we were thinking about doing, try to get some buy-in, see who might be interested. And we'd spend a few months starting down this process, meeting regularly, and that we would come after like 6 months, we would make a decision about whether or not we thought, okay, this is a thing worth really pursuing. There's enough interest, there's enough energy behind it that we should really do this, really start this company. And there was, you know, the group grew over the course of the 6 months rather than shrinking. And it felt like people understood and cared about that idea, that mission. And I think I underestimated something that was present in a lot of artists, which I think you know well, frankly, through the farm, which is finding community is really hard. And finding creative space where you feel genuinely seen and fulfilled is really hard. And so what I kept hearing from, especially the actors, was, wow, to be back in a room where my ideas, my mind, my creative energy is valued in this way, even though I don't know exactly what this thing is going to become, is worth it to me because it's unlike my experience in a lot of the profession. And when I realized that, it felt like a thing worth doing.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because all of our jobs outside of places that are clearly laboratories, like grad acting or somewhere in a developmental utopian, is you're going towards a product, and you sort of lose track of the fact that we're making art.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very funny that Mark Wang is the person who started, because I think he does that in the room.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he sets up that process even when he's doing your traditional 5-week rehearsal process. It's an exploration throughout, and how valuable that is to, you don't want it to be a respite. You want that to be the whole experience, I think. You know, you don't want it to be an oasis. You want to feel like, oh, that's how I work.
Yeah, that's right. And to your point about, being a part of an institution or, being in academia, I think that's true. I mean, I am lucky to have a job that means that I, have a paycheck and that it's, in the field, but it also, there's a kind of instant community, and of course, like anything, sometimes you wish you had time away from it, or you feel, constrained by it. I mean, all those things are very natural, but what you are is a part of a creative community that's deeply invested in just the act of investigating, creating, building in all of those ways. And when that's a big part of your life, like it is for me, I think you can lose perspective about, when people graduate, what then the deserts of that they enter sometimes.
Yeah. And society. So, I mean, I know you launched right before the pandemic and stayed engaged, and then you did your first two shows in rep. You're going to do another one in 20. Do you know what the show is in 23?
We don't quite. We basically, we run the group like a collective, which means that there isn't a kind of leadership model. Any big decisions get voted on by the whole group. And then there's committees that handle kind of smaller tasks, fundraising or, whatever. And we've just been through the process of talking through what the next thing might be, or kind of roughly. And then starting in January, we'll begin the actual research investigation process. But the truth is, it's hard to know at the beginning what the thing is actually going to turn into. The first play that Mona and I did, Beginning Days of True Jubilation, started as an investigation of what makes a crowd become a mob. And it turned into a play about a fictional tech startup that collapses. And that was just, the game of telephone of what gets more and more interesting as you research it.
And that tech startup is the mob.
That's right. Exactly. Or all those conversations around groupthink and the way we lose identity inside a group, and it's all that stuff.
It's difficult existence as a freelance artist, playwright, actor, director, trying to find temporary homes to work in. And so when you're creating the society, when you're creating the company, where do you gather?
Yeah, a few different places. I mean, obviously there's a lot of virtual gathering, but then since then it's been about, rented spaces, or sometimes we can borrow space at NYU, or, we're members of Art New York. And so sometimes we rent space there. That's a challenge in trying to kind of build community in that way, is that you have to exist. You have no choice but to exist inside capitalism. And so sometimes we talk as a group about, like, okay, well, how are we hacking capitalism? How can we've got this notion that is in some respects anti-capitalist, which is very long form explorations that lead to this very inefficient thing, which is making a play. And how do we do that while also just having no choice but to exist inside the system we're in? And so, yeah, finding people you can partner with, or groups that give you opportunities to use space or friends who you can borrow stuff from, or trading in whatever way you can.
And I want to ask about that in the trading and the partnerships is how do you dismantle? I was looking at the website about the dismantling the financial system of theater. I don't remember the actual word it was. And it's still asking people to, still people have to show up to invest in that exploration. So it's like it's a, at some point it's a passion and then at some point it's a profession, right? And it's, and you're bringing both of those to the organization, right? Because not every, making an assumption, but not every minute of the year is paid, right?
Correct.
So people are showing up because they care. And then there's a point when it gets traction and it becomes, now we're doing paid work of some kind.
That's right. Yeah, the basically the way we've roughly set it up now is that in the kind of development phase, while we're developing a play, we also have these meetings, these sessions, which we call percolators, where any member can bring in an idea. Sometimes members lead kind of exercises or workshops with one another, or people have some pages they want to read, or they just have, an experiment they want to do with the group. And so the notion there is that while we're working together as a group, not kind of rehearsing a play, the community is in service of everyone in the community. So you want to use this time and space to investigate this thing, then people are going to show up. You're not going to pay them. They're not going to pay you. And you're all taking care of one another by supporting your artistic interests and endeavors during these kind of creative periods. That's the kind of barter version of it, right? You're getting labor, and you're also giving labor to the group during that period. Then, when we have a production, we move into a somewhat more traditional model with some twists, like the group votes on the budget for the production, right? We establish the budget, what everyone would be paid, all that stuff. The budget is entirely visible to everybody in the group. Everyone knows what everyone else is getting, what everything costs. And we pay every person the same. So all the actors are getting the same amount of money, all the designers are getting the same. It was a shock to me to discover that it's not uncommon for like a set designer to get twice as much as a costume designer. That seems totally ridiculous. And
Yes.
I suspect sexist historically. And but even just saying to the designers, look, the group voted on this, you're getting paid the same as everybody else. There's no mystery to it. There's no here, you can see the budget the same way everybody else can see the budget. That has been a way to say, look, I wish we could pay triple, but at the very least, what we can do is make it incredibly transparent.
I'm really interested in how you came to your process of exploration and like you're saying about research and bringing in ideas and then doing exercises and from that and finding the work. How did you find your method?
Yeah, I think, I was very lucky in that growing up, I mostly grew up in New Jersey. And growing up, I was a part of this, I took classes at this theater and was part of this theater called the Youth Theater of New Jersey. And it just so happened that they did not, it wasn't a place like many schools are where like you pick a script and then they produce the play and you run it for 2 weekends at your school or whatever. Instead, it was a place that did a lot of new plays and we did a lot of devising and stuff like that, even as kids, with kind of a teacher or director helping. And so the truth is, I never did a play that had a script where I wasn't some part of the making of that script until I went to college. It was the first time I ever was introduced to the notion of like, here's the script, here's the first day of rehearsal, and now we begin. And I think the result was that I was a little disillusioned in college about how small the role of an actor was. Because I got my BFA in acting at DePaul at the theater school. And I thought I wanted to be an actor, but I think in part because I thought being an actor meant something more than it mostly does.
Right. It meant creating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I felt like I had more of a creative role. And it was partway through college that a teacher said something to me, which was felt terrible at the time, but in retrospect was true, which was, she said, you know, Scott, I think, you know, I think you are meant to be, you know, a part of the theater. I'm not sure you're meant to be an actor. And being in school for acting, not the thing you're looking to hear from a teacher. It was a kind of crisis, but, you know, I took it on as a well-meaning statement. And I had one or two other moments. I had this great mentor, this guy, Joe Slowick, who had been teaching there a long time. And one day I just was in the hall and he taught a directing class as well. And he happened to see me walking by in the hall and he said, you know, Scott, you should be in this class, you know? And I knew he was teaching the directing class and he said it generously. And those moments stuck with me and made me realize, oh, there's something else about this work that is actually more who I am as an artist, and it isn't acting. And I was looking at people who I thought, oh, they're better actors than me, and they love doing it, and they're not feeling what I'm feeling about the limitations, what I perceived as the limitations of the job. So honestly, by the time I graduated college, I was pretty sure that maybe acting exclusively was not my role. And the result is that I just kept finding opportunities to do more than act, to direct or to teach or to whatever. And so much of my studying growing up and what was exciting to me in school was quite physical. It was very kind of exploratory physical work. So that I think my own aesthetic built out of the things that I liked about acting and the things that I liked about creating.
And when you say physical, I also know that I don't know if this is directly related to the physical action work that you do. Is that something that was taught or is that developed? Did you develop that idea or is that taught to you?
I developed it, but entirely to the credit of all the other things I learned. Do you know what I mean? That, you know, I think the physical actioning work that I kind of developed is a function of, you know, a combination of a range of acting movement works I studied. I became a Feldenkrais practitioner, which is a kind of movement method that heavily influenced that, alongside other kind of text analysis tools using action verbs. And all of that really fed into my feeling that, oh, I really like working on plays, but I want a vocabulary that I feel like pulls together the way we talk about text and the way we talk about physical character work into a kind of unified vocabulary or set of exercises. And so that's what set me on the path of developing the physical actioning, which felt to me like the right blend of those things.
Yeah, I think that's what I didn't know if it was already in existence, a foundational thing, because I did know that it came from the work you were doing. I just didn't know if it was you combining them. And I think it's great. And is that some of the workshops you're doing on sabbatical at the schools are through physical action, right? Am I saying it right if I say physical actioning? Is that the workshop?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. That's mostly what I'm doing on in these workshops and sabbaticals. Sometimes, you know, doing other things, but a lot of it is finding opportunities to teach physical actioning workshops.
And can you just talk about it a little bit? What are you illustrating to them? Like, I know you were in Evansville and at University, Indiana?
Mm-hmm. University of Evansville.
Evansville. Is it a couple of days that you're with? Are you starting to do practical storytelling? Is it like the work you're doing with Society of creating something, or how does it work?
Yeah, there's kind of two versions that I've been doing, kind of depending upon how much time I have with a group. So, for instance, I was down at SMU for a week and working with their MFA students. And because I had a whole week with one set of students, we started from just purely physical exercises and experiments using these action verbs in these very expanded ways, really experiencing full physical versions of them, and then using a series of exercises to slowly find the way that they might be expressed through text ultimately, or text and body together. So I'll often use the metaphor of like a pasta maker, the way that like the raw impulse, that action is the kind of raw dough, and then all the rules of the world are the pasta maker that squeeze it into a certain shape in which it's permitted to come out, right? And so a lot of the exercises over that week are about taking identifying some of those raw impulses, how might those live in you, and then figuring out what does it mean to keep your body alive and keep them present in your whole body, but still squeeze them into the rules of the world, which often demand that text is a primary way you communicate those actions. And so that arc is the arc of the kind of workshop. And sometimes I'm able to just do the exploratory stuff with groups if I only have a little bit of time. But ideally, I've been able to take them from those expanded impulses into those more kind of channeled impulses on some kind of text.
It's nice, and I love the idea that they start doing. It's funny, I think about the physical, just the storytelling through the physical is apparent in your work, and I think it's great. And I actually just went and gave feedback to a community college production through the Kennedy Center thing, you know, and 90% of my thought was, it'd be nice if you were in your body.
Yeah. It's so, I mean, it's one of those things that's so hard. And I think it's become harder over time because there's because so much of the media people not just consume but make is in a very small frame. Like, think about it's funny for you and I to talk about TikTok, but let's talk about TikTok for a minute, Patrick. which
Well,
is to say,
I watch your channel.
which is to say, you know, here you have this kind of narrow vertical frame. And so that even when people are dancing, the dances are quite narrow. That's, yeah, all of that kind of stuff, or so much of it is just people's heads talking in social media. And so I do think it's hard anyway to be a person feeling free to live in your body. But I think it's become harder because we have so many fewer examples of it.
Yeah, and that is true. Like people are creating things that are not expansive. Yes, they're you know, even I was thinking about self-tape for the TikTok for the dance or whatever people are video, like you said, is it's a narrow frame, but then also I'm thinking about the self-tape in the audition. Like,
Yes.
you know, you get in a room, you can make a choice, you can something a spontaneous thing can happen and respond to something. And you're on a self-tape, your response better spontaneously be in frame.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so much initial theater auditions now even are self-tapes that people submit. So it's very hard, I think.
What do you think, besides the standing in the hallway and having a teacher say maybe it's not acting, and the confidence that it is what it is now, but what do you think you bring with you today when you walk into a room as an artist that you might have not brought with you 15 years ago?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, maybe I'll start by answering the reverse, which is I strangely I bring tremendous insecurity with me into the room. Frankly, that feels like it's actually the thing I bring strongest into the room, which is, you know, doing all these workshops and
I'm
traveling
going to
around.
interrupt. Did you
Yeah.
bring insecurity with you 15 years ago?
No, certainly not. No, I also brought in insecurity, but I think I always feel worried that this group of people will, I won't communicate what I'm trying to clearly, or they won't get it, or they won't like it, or what I feel worried anytime I'm meeting a new group of students about that kind of thing. I think the way I get over it now is I just have a lot more evidence in favor of the fact that it tends to work out.
Has it ever not worked out?
It's never completely not worked out, but I think, look, you don't. Everyone's not a great fit as a collaborator, and everyone doesn't like what you're selling, as it were. And so I think, yeah, of course, there are times when there are students or groups who don't get it. But I think, whereas a long time ago, that might have sent me to a place where I was like, well, maybe this has all been a terrible mistake. Now I think it sends me to a place which is it feels bad, but I think, okay, what can I learn from that? What can I take away? Where's my responsibility in that? What shifts could I make so that I am a better communicator, tomorrow or with the next group?
Yeah, I like that you focus that. Well, I ask because it doesn't feel good, right, when it doesn't work. And now doing it for so long, you're like, well, I know it's valuable. So either that wasn't a receptive collaborator, or like you said, I got to communicate. And it's good. We can just make adjustments of taking the inventory and say, like, all right, it's worked for so many other times.
Yeah. And I think I don't, I think one always has to be careful about self-delusion in that there's certainly been times over the years where I've thought, oh, this is a good idea, and I try it and it fails a couple of times. And then you have to be able to say, that is not a good idea. That was actually, it turns out I was wrong and I should set that aside,
Yeah, or yeah, or figure out why I thought it was a good idea and figure out if I can make it a better idea.
Yes,
You
certainly.
know, because I also think there's value in putting things down,
A
like you
hundred
said,
percent.
and letting go. I want to ask one more question on the going into rooms. You've gone to Kyiv to work, and I'm going to get the other place wrong. Was it Peru?
No, Uruguay. I was there. I went there three times, I think, to Uruguay.
And I find it interesting and terrifying to walk into a room where maybe English isn't their primary language or at all. And how is that for you? And what is that dance to start to collaborate?
Yeah, I find it terrifying too. I think, in the case of Uruguay, I had a really wonderful kind of colleague and translator who was there, also an acting teacher who was there all the time, and who I felt, really confident that I was being understood through translation, even when students couldn't necessarily understand me. The thing that kind of kept me going back, other than the community itself, was a feeling that, oh, being challenged to really distill and clearly communicate in a way that can be readily translated is good for me. It forces me to understand my own ideas with clarity. And it also did something vital, not just there, but in general, which is it made me really aware of the relationship between ideas and cultural context. And so, what are the things that seemed to be communicative and consistent and useful no matter what? And what are the things that I needed to make a kind of cultural shift or a shift in my cultural understanding to communicate better? I think that was a good reminder that even when I'm in New York teaching with students who are primarily from the United States, that there are still substantial cultural differences at times and experiential differences that need to be accounted for by me as a teacher. And so that was a good way to leave the US and have that be primary so that I can understand it more clearly. So that was a great thing. Or even just, I had to let go of some things. I directed a play down there, and you know, in Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish, and so I'm working with a script with a translation, but trying to direct the play. And there are moments where I'm responding to something in the acting, and I'm asking for a shift, and you know, it raised really interesting questions about, oh, am I receiving that because I don't understand the context of the language? Is there like a cultural difference about touch, for instance, or various other things that I'm responding to the material in a way that the audience here might not, and really be humble about what is it that our audience here in this place will receive of this moment in the play, and how can I make that clear, not just clear to me?
Well, I think that's great. And I think it's good to be reminded, you're right, going outside of the community, because especially if we're trying to have awareness at all times about being inclusive and the cultural experiences aren't the same. But also, as you were talking, I thought, right, our culture might have shame around something that another culture doesn't have shame around, you know, and how do you check in besides just the actor response, but making sure that you're understanding why that response is happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's great. I love the conversation, and I love what I really respect about you is the idea that you have a process and that you bring it into all, it seems that you bring it into all the rooms with you. And I love talking with you about how that's come about. But I would love to ask if you have advice to anyone who's starting out on a career and in theater. What do you, besides, you know, going to NYU or not going to NYU?
I mean, I think when I think about my own trajectory, I feel like the two things that made the biggest difference were mentorship, of course. I mean, I spoke a bit about Mark, but he was maybe my last great mentor, as it were, but he was certainly not the only one. And I was lucky in that people offered mentorship to me, and I feel really passionate about trying to offer that to other people as a result. But I've also seen people ask for mentorship, and I think that's okay too. I think if you know, finding somebody who you like or admire, whose work you want to understand, or even they're doing something you think, I don't understand how they're doing it, and I want to understand how they're doing it. I think people are more open to letting people in than you expect. And there's no replacement for just that relationship that allows you to be vulnerable and not be the person who knows everything, and to be a learner and to have that person as a sounding board because they've become invested in you as a person. That to me feels like wherever you can find it, people should be trying to find it. And then the second thing is about not holding too tightly to the path that you think you want to have. When I look back, if I had held too tightly to some of my decisions about who I thought I was supposed to be or what I thought I wanted, I think I would have missed opportunities that came along that seemed just off to the side, or they seemed exciting to me, but I couldn't say why they felt that way because they didn't make sense at the moment. And I'm so glad that mostly I said yes to those things, because it kind of made my life what it was. But I think there's a fine line between abandoning the things you're passionate about for ease or holding too tightly to things that it's okay to loosen your grip on.
Yeah, because you didn't know, like, oh, I'm going to finish grad school in New York. You know, nobody plans that, and that doesn't sound, but the willingness to remain open to it opened up a whole path to you. And I think that is great to not hold on to the rein of who you what you think it's supposed to be like, because I also think it's never what it's supposed to be like.
No.
You know, I don't know anyone who's like, oh, I was going to do this and I did it, and then everything happened exactly as I imagined it.
Yeah, and I think we model ourselves after the people we admire when we look at their lives backwards. And that's not, it's true that that was their life in some respect, but it's very hard to identify all the forks in a road, when you look backwards.
Right, because you're tracing the dots that connected and not the ones that went nowhere.
That's right, exactly. And so many dots go nowhere, and yet they were perfectly good to follow, you know.
So good to talk to Scott. I mean, that was great. He's so thoughtful, and I also like his humor about the fact that he didn't want to start a theater company, because and that it came about out of being encouraged publicly by people who supported that idea. And Society is a great theater company. You should check it out and check it out on the web and learn about what they're doing. And all of their projects are interesting and the ensemble strong. So I encourage that. But I loved it. I loved talking with him and hearing about how he, you know, found a way to slowly carve his identity and artistry into the work he's doing at NYU, and it seems like an organic and good fit. But I also love that he brings that artistry and his process into everything that he does. You know, that's the goal and the gift, and I feel like you can do it. And I also love that he talked about imagining in the advice, you know, when he talked about not holding on to that tight vision of who you think you're supposed to be, because you never know. You know, just remain open. And I know I feel like I've heard that a lot lately, and it's really good. And also the thing Andrew Chenevay talked about, mentors, and Scott talked about that, finding that person who invests in you and to really ask them questions and take the time and value it. And I thought that was it was lovely. It was all really good. And it was just a nice conversation, and I appreciate it. And thank you, Scott. And as we are, you know, this is the last episode before the new year. Again, as I said at the beginning, hope everybody gets a chance to, you know, relax and recharge. And, you know, for me, it's funny. I feel like every new year I sort of do make a, not a resolution, but a sort of a commitment of an artistic goal or something that I want to do differently this year or how I want to approach to work. And I hope you get that time to recharge and take inventory and stock of like, oh, this is what I'm doing that I love. This is what I would like to do less of. And here's how, what I want to do more. And how can I do that? And remaining open and listening to the conversation with Scott, there's many ways to do it. And, you know, finding your own path, and after time, finding a it that path becomes built. I also love that he said that thing about when we look at someone's path, it all makes sense because the dots connecting, but we didn't see what didn't work, and we didn't see what they wanted that they didn't get that took them in another direction. And so I think as I'm entering into the new year, I want to say I'm going to remain open and keep trying to take the steps that take me in the direction I want to go. So I hope that we're all doing that too. And enjoy whatever time you get now in a little break. And with that, we're out.